The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Shia Cohen, and I'm going to be conducting this first of two sessions that will continue tomorrow evening on the topic of strengthening emunah in the classroom. Must admit that as recent as 10 years ago, maybe even a little more recently, a topic like this was not discussed in polite religious company, even amongst mechanchim. For some reason, there was a feeling that this is something that's superfluous, not necessary to talk about. Everybody knows about. What are you making an issue about anyway? Maybe you'll bring up more questions than answers. And for many different, varied, and often not so necessarily rational reasons, this topic was not to be discussed. At a recent Torah Masorah convention, the most recent, it seems that, I don't remember the exact nusach of the overall theme, but it seemed that this topic was actually the theme of the convention. So in terms of the recognition for the need to discuss these issues, I think we've come full circle. I believe that for years it was considered taboo with a bit of a misunderstanding. We find the Goyin writes that even though he highly recommends the Sefer Chovos HaLevavos, the shar that deals with Yichud Hashem, the first shar should not be learned. That was his recommendation. And many people took from that that that's in Yonei Emunah. We don't discuss these things. But what I think that they forgot to read was the next line, where he suggests instead learning the Sefer HaKuzri, HaKuzri HaRishon, he says, Shehi Sefer Yokor Me'oid. There's something very special about it. And the Kuzri, we know, is a rational approach to the recognition of the veracity of the Mesoira of Torah Misinai. So, be that as it may, today this topic has been deemed appropriate to discuss in a format such as this, and therefore we are here for these two sessions tonight and tomorrow evening. We like to present it more in the form of an overview of the sugya, so to speak, this evening, and then tomorrow evening, delving into some more specific information which can be helpful in applying some of these concepts in the classroom. I think that there are many misunderstandings when it comes to the concept of emunah. Maybe the first and maybe even the most serious misunderstanding is that emunah is a misnomer. We're not really talking about emunah. Emunah, as understood, as translated roughly as belief, that presents an image or a concept of one who chooses or wishes to accept certain facts, certain realities, certain teachings as true, and I believe because I want to believe in them. Probably a more accurate word to describe what we're talking about is yediyah. In fact, the yesod of the mitzvah of emunah, which is derived from the posuk Onoichi Hashem Elokecha Asher Yitzeisicho Me'eretz Mitzrayim Mibeis Avodim, was certainly the ultimate yediyah. The Borei Olam introduces himself personally with his own voice at Har Sinai and says, Shalom Aleichem, Onoichi Hashem Elokecha, I'm the one. Asher Yitzeisicho Me'eretz Mitzrayim. You just witnessed all of these miracles bringing you to this point. That's me. That wasn't begeder believing. That was begeder knowledge. You can't know any better than that. And the Rambam in his right at the beginning of Yesod HaTorah, talks about the Yesod of everything, the Lodas, the idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu exists, and he's the Mesabiv Kol HaSibos, and the Mamzi Kol HaNimtzois, and we speak about idea. And basically, the idea is to convey the information and the knowledge that there's a Bir Yoylam, and that the Bir Yoylam revealed himself at Sinai, and the Bir Yoylam has given us the manual for living a life which is for our benefit, for our good, for benefit in this world, and ultimate in eternal schar in the Olam HaNitzchi. And this is all part of that which we are supposed to know, and knowledge that we are supposed to convey to our students. The question is it easy? Need it just be told as it was at Har Sinai? Or do we need today, and maybe in previous generations as well, do we need today more of an understanding and more of a motivation and more of a basic insight in order to be able to recognize and appreciate and accept this yediyah? And I think the answer to that can be found on many different levels. But very simply put, we say every day in the Birchas Kriya Shema of Shachris, after we finish the Kabbalah Soil Malchus Shomayim, Yichud Hashem, Kabbalah Soil Mitzvus, Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim, say about 15, I believe it is, words. And these 15 words, the Loshon of the Gemara is Emes V'yatziv D'Raisa, that these included in these words is part of the Kiyum Mitzvah D'Raisa of Yetzias Mitzrayim, Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim, Kabbalah Soil Malchus Shomayim. And the words, of course, are V'yatziv v'nochoin v'kayom v'yoshor v'ne'emon v'yohuv v'choviv v'nechmod v'noim v'noiro v'adir v'msukon v'kubol v'toy v'yofe. And in here, I believe, lies the secret to the yedios, to the knowledge that we wish to impart. It's emes, it's true. V'yatziv v'nochoin v'kayom v'yoshor v'ne'emon. But it's also ohu v'chovi v'nechmod v'noim v'adir sukon kubol v'toy v'yofe. And I believe the yesod of conveying the information of the ideas of Torah Misinai is based upon the realization that it's a two-part process. It has to do with the fact that this is emes, and it has to do with the fact that this is relevant, beautiful, pleasant, sweet, precious, meaningful, and I guess in modern parlance, it's going to make me happy. And that's really the message. And unless we have both elements clearly articulated and clearly understood by our students, the message is not really going to get successfully across. In fact, the Emes V'yatziv D'Raisa says that we ourselves, having known this and having lived this and having practiced this and having studied this and having repeated this every single day, every day after Kriya Shema, V'yatziv V'nochoin V'kayom V'yoshor V'ohuv V'choviv V'nechmod, this is the yesod of what we have to feel in order to be ready to accept. And what that really means is that even though knowledge is different from belief, and belief is most directly affected by the emotion, however, even knowledge needs an emotional component. Of course, the reason is not because I have to want to believe, to know in order to have the knowledge, but rather, if I don't want it, I won't pay attention, I won't listen, I won't focus, I'll find excuses, all kinds of rationalizations. If the person isn't ready, if the person doesn't recognize that this knowledge is going to serve me well, then my mind closes up, I'm blinded, I'm not interested, I'm not ready to be mekabel. So we definitely need this combination of understanding, that there is information, there is knowledge. In fact, I think the best words to describe this knowledge are twofold. We have evidence to the Maimon Har Sinai, and we have testimony to the Maimon Har Sinai. We'll try to touch on both of them. However, if I do not perceive that the end result of this yediyah is going to make my life better, is going to make me a happier person, is going to be sweet and pleasant and relevant and everything else, then in one way or another, the Yetzer Hara will interfere with either the process of acquiring the knowledge, the process of retaining the knowledge, the process of living according to that knowledge. At some point, because of the emotional component, I'm going to fight and eventually reject that knowledge. So this is the combination. And what that really means is that there's a lot of work that has to be done to ready our students for this knowledge. The internal debate right now is between the positive approach and the negative approach. The negative approach is so much more direct and lucid. Positive approach sells better out there, so maybe we'll walk in between. Let's just say that maybe we have not succeeded enough in conveying the benefits of the knowledge of Torah MiSinai to our students. Let's just say that our students may still be under the influence of those famous quotes that they heard from their grandparents and great-grandparents. You know, it's so difficult. There's so many problems. It's such a burden. There's so many restrictions. And sometimes this feeling that they have is almost enhanced by the educational process. Because many times we tend to take for granted, of course they know the benefits. Of course they know the truth. The only thing they're lacking is the information. Let's give them the information. And when we burden them with all of this information and its myriads of details, we're not just talking about the fact that there's 613 problems that they have to accept, because half of those problems or more are not even problems today. You know, we don't even have the ability to observe all the mitzvahs. But all of the details of the Dalit Chilkei Shulchan Aruch and the Si'ifim Ketanim and the prote dinim and all of these things that they learn. So it's very overwhelming. Sometimes it becomes too overwhelming. And if we assume that they understand and that they know that this is Torah MiSinai, and that they know to the depths of their neshama that this is for their benefit and it's going to make them happy and it's going to enhance their life and give them meaning and purpose in life and so forth and so on. If we assume that and just give them the details, then I think we may be missing the point. Because in order to internalize, in order to focus, in order to study, in order to review, in order to accept these details, they have to know v'yatziv v'nochoin v'kayom v'yoshor v'nechmod v'ohu v'choviv. And if not, if they don't have that sense of both, or if we tend to take for granted that they do have that sense of both when they don't, we may be in for a lot of resistance, not to mention rebellion. I think it's also important to understand that a life of Torah mitzvahs in a world so seemingly free of burden and responsibility is a lot of pressure. It is. It really burdens them. It demands a lot. And remember that in the younger ages, they're less apt to feel the benefits. They haven't been frustrated as much by the lack of meaning in life, to look and search for meaning as older people, adults, and maybe in the high teenage years may have begun to do. So they're just like burden, problem, responsibility, translates to pressure, and pressure always evokes resistance. So there's a natural sense of resistance which could very well. Now, by the way, we're not talking about everybody under every circumstance, and that's not what we're here for this evening. But we're talking about many more than we thought that we're talking about. In fact, on some level, we're talking about most of us, because emes v'yatziv is a chiyuv d'oraisa for everyone. Are women mechuyev and emes v'yatziv? I'm not sure. But anyway, but it's a chiyuv d'oraisa. The concept is critical. So I think it's extremely important for us not to take these things for granted, which I think means that there are a number of issues that have to be dealt with, just preparing the ground for our students to be ready to begin to recognize the truth of Torah Mi-Sinai. And you have in your notebooks here some outlines, which I'm going to try to follow only for the purpose of, I think it's easier for anyone who wishes to review. And a number of points which I think are critical for this process. We live in a very materialistic world. Some think that that's a terrible, terrible problem. A terrible nisoyin. This is the biggest problem of our generation, the materialism. Well, on one level, it's probably true. But on another level, it's a tremendous brocha, because people are reaching their level of frustration so much younger and so much earlier than they used to. Because it used to be it takes you till you're 60, till you had a decent living, and you're ready to do a couple of things, and by that time, you know, it starts to hurt over here and over here, and before you know it, it's time to buy your plot and get ready to move in. So people never expected that much. Today, we have everything. By the time I'm 30, if I'm not a millionaire, something is wrong. And then by the time I'm 35, with a beautiful family and a beautiful home and beautiful cars and successful business and an empty feeling inside, people are beginning to realize that there has to be something more to life. So we have to allow our students, in whatever way possible, you know, I'm not saying to come into the classroom and talk about the suicide rate and the rate of alcohol and drug abuse divorce and you know, but in a sense, these are the things, the ills of society shake us up a little bit and say, hey, there's something wrong. It's not all about fun and frolic living in a material world. I think we also have to be able to show that the world is less than honest in how it deals with issues. When you have the opportunity to show that the information that we're given in the newspapers are sometimes not exactly the way it is, there's great bias. When we have the opportunity to show that even the scientific community, whose science is appreciated as the ultimate of truth, they fabricate, forge, phony, and misrepresent so many things just because it fits their worldview. And every time these things are shown up in the papers, and there are so many opportunities in life, and when you have an opportunity to show, hey, society isn't as great as it seems to be. Materialism doesn't make people happy as I would have thought. It's not about pleasure. In fact, if you'll study some of the pleasure capitals of the world, you'll find that they have the highest suicide rate and highest drug abuse rate and highest alcohol abuse and the greatest divorce rate and so forth and so on. And everybody has at least two shrinks. In fact, one of those communities, I think it was Beverly Hills, invented the concept of a canine shrink. You have to take your dog to a shrink as well. So if they begin to see, and again, don't attack. We can't attack, because when you attack, then you make the society or the materialism the nirduf. And everybody gets on the side of the nirduf. But just gently, if you have an opportunity, something happened. You know, the best way to teach values is, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the office. You're just like, you know, chilach yad, like you're almost like talking to yourself. And you're not trying to convince anybody of anything. That's why it's good to have a sense of humor in the classroom. Because if you're perceived to be in a jovial mood, then in a joke, they're not as defensive, they're not as nervous, they're not as resistant, because, you know, we're just having a good time. It's not as serious. But we have to find ways, quiet ways, kelachar yad ways, you know, agav urcha ways, to show that society is not everything that it was cracked up to be. Materialism does not do it for you alone. People need much more in life. Number one. Number two, part of the reason that some of our kids have such difficulty with Yiddishkeit, and again, I'm almost apologetic because there may be people sitting in this room that don't believe that our kids have difficulty with accepting Yiddishkeit. I think some people are smiling and say that, how could I make such a stupid statement? But there are some of us that may still think that. And it's a very, I think, a very limited view of what's really going on out there. It's a magefa. It's a makas medina. In fact, oftentimes in some of the finest and most apparently frum and normal yeshiva situations, when you delve a little deeper, you begin to find that, yeah, I'm not really sure what happened at Har Sinai. And that's really what it's all about. It's all about what happened that day at Har Sinai 3,320 years ago. That's really what it's all about. And not too clear, not too sure. Some will tell you, well, we never really talked about it. Nobody ever explained it to me. Whatever the reason is, but it's something that we have to deal with. Part of what's helping our youth sometimes to resist this information or to not focus on it or to not pay so much attention to it or to recognize that they're going to be threatened by it, it's something that they really don't want to buy into, and therefore there's some resistance, is some of the misconceptions that they have about Yiddishkeit. I hear from our kids very often that they have not only misconceptions about Yiddishkeit, they have misconceptions about the Rabbeinu Shalom. They sing with gusto. No, they're not happy about it. Kel Nekomis Hashem. They know the God of vengeance. They know about suffering. They know about punishment. They know about fear. They don't know that much about love. They don't understand what Shlomo HaMelech taught us in Shir HaShirim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all ani ledoidi vedoidi li, doidi li v'ani loy. That's, in fact, Rashi says that the reason loy hoyo ha'olam kedai ki yom shenitin bo Shir HaShirim is because kol ha'kisvei kodesh or kodesh. Shir HaShirim is kodesh kodoshim shekuloi avas kuloi yira shomayim v'kibul ol malchusoy. Shir HaShirim is all about yira shomayim kabol ol malchus shomayim. I don't understand what he's talking about. There isn't a word of Yira in Shir HaShirim. It's all the Digloy Olay Ava. It's all about Ava. The Teretz is the Yesod of the Yira Shomayim that is of the purest form is based on Ava. We're Mekabel the Malchus Shomayim every day, but first we say Ava Rabba. We say Ava Seilim. We say Abayich Rabamu Yisrael B'Avo. We say Oyev Amu Yisrael. And then we're ready for Kabbalah Sa Malchus Shomayim. It isn't about fear per se, and certainly not for our children. They have to first feel this sense of Ava. They have to first feel how much HaKadosh Baruch Hu cares about them. They have to first feel this sense of Chashivus, this sense of uniqueness, this sense of Bonim Atem Lashem Lekechem. And we, as Mechanchim and Mechanchis, have to motivate them with positive motivation, with this feeling of appreciation, HaKadosh Baruch Hu loves us, ani ledoidi vedoidi li, doidi li v'ani loy, and this is what it's about. And if they feel that, then they're much more ready to accept and to study and to focus and to recognize and to be mekabel. So this is, I think, a misconception that a lot of our kids feel. They feel this negativity. They feel this sense of pachad, and it creates an inordinate amount of pressure, and they feel, well, if that's what it's all about, and again, these things are not going on consciously for most of our kids, but on a subconscious level, they're all human, and there becomes a certain resistance. Kids have questions. Many years ago, and again, I believe that this has changed, it was very usual to hear from a young man or a young woman, I wasn't free to ask any questions in the classroom. In fact, when I asked a question, I was told, leave the room. Or, better yet, I was told, someone who asks such a question doesn't belong in a school like this. I was told this publicly in front of a whole classroom, too. And that feeling, I think, is changing today. But it's critical to be able to answer questions. Now, sometimes the answer is, I don't know. That's a fine answer. In fact, I remember Abchaskal Abramsky once told us that when he came to London, he became the dayan in London the first day, that the Reish HaKol, who came to see him, and he asked him a shayla, and he says, I don't know. And everybody was up in arms. It was a simple shayla, how come he doesn't know? And the Reish HaKol called the previous dayan who had pushed him into the position, and they said, what is this business? What kind of rov did you give us? He doesn't know such a simple thing. And the old dayan was upset, and he calls Rabbi Abramsky. Of course I knew the answer. The first lesson that the Jews of London have to learn is that the Rav doesn't have to know everything. And if it applies to Reb Chatzkel Abramsky, it certainly applies to us. We don't have to know all the answers. But we have to be willing to listen. We have to recognize that listening to their question validates them, makes them feel good about themselves, makes them feel that we are open to questions, makes them feel that we're not hiding anything from them, and makes them feel ready to pursue further and to try to understand because somebody sympathetic there is willing to work with them. Now, not every question can be answered in the classroom. Not every question can be discussed in the classroom. Sometimes we're not prepared. Sometimes we don't know. Sometimes it's not appropriate for the class. But it can be dealt with. It's a very good question. The first answer is a very good. Once you say it's a very good question already, half the battle is won. Because most of the times they just want to hear that it's a good question. They're not even interested in the answer. But if you get one that's really interested in the answer, we'll discuss it later. Or, you know, I don't know the answer, but I'll go home and I'll find out the answer. But it's a sincere and open effort to deal with a child and his or her issues and questions, which is critical. How many of the kids who have gone off the derech, so to speak, attributed to the fact that I always asked questions that nobody was even willing to listen to? And the message was, I'm worthless, and the Torah? Not so, very vulnerable, let's say. And that's why the teacher was afraid to deal with the issues. So this is an extremely important point in dealing with, and our kids do have questions, and encouraging their questions is not making them think of questions they don't have. It's bringing to the fore things that are gnawing away at them subconsciously and that can undermine more of the yesodis of emunah in their lives than the fact that they express it. And especially if we can deal with it, or if we can't deal with it, we get them someone who can deal with it. And by the way, today there's so much that's written, that's printed in dealing with questions. I mean, we're under this well-known Judaica Plus up there, you know, not to put in a plug for any one particular establishment, but every week there's volumes and volumes that are being published, and I assume some of them are quite good at dealing with the issues and the problems and the questions that come up. Maybe it means a lot of extra work for us to read, but I'm certain that it's worth the price, both materially and emotionally and spiritually and intellectually. Something else that's very important. And how to do it is a technique, is a skill. Maybe I'm going to give you just two examples which are used very actively in the world of Jewish outreach. But they have their place, and certainly the likes of them have their place in the classroom as well. If we're not in the market to buy something, then we usually don't even notice the advertisement. It's a wise salesman who doesn't try to sell a potential customer on a need that he doesn't know that he has, but rather to try to present to him that this is something that you've been looking for all along. That's the wisdom, the general wisdom in marketing today. And our students also have to first be looking for what we have to tell them. Otherwise, they're not as receptive and as inquisitive and as open-minded and as focused on the message as otherwise they could be. I'll give you maybe just one, because we are limited in time, just one example, which I heard this from Dr. Shalom Srebrenik, who's I call him the conceptual genius behind this whole Arachim seminar movement, which is responsible for so much of the analysis of so many of these principles that we're talking about. And he said, he made up a story, I'm sure. Story goes something like this, that a gentleman decided that he wants to marry a certain woman because of her money. She was the heir to fortunes and money, and he decided that this would be a very good way to spend the rest of his life. He began to date her and court her and so forth until her brother found out about it. And he put him up against the wall and threatened his life. You know, dare you do such a thing and get out of here and the whole business. And he says, wait a minute. He says, I'm a Hollywood actor. This is what the suitor said. I'm a Hollywood actor. I'm a pretty good one. Your sister will never know that I married her for her money. She'll never know. I'll play the role for the rest of our lives. She'll be the happiest woman on earth. I'll take care of her. The brother, for some reason, I guess because we needed this story, agreed. Didn't say anything. They got married. 50 years of marital bliss, wining and dining her with her credit cards and so forth, but she loved every minute of it. He's on his deathbed, and for some reason he's motivated to spill the beans, and he calls her in and he says, I got to tell you something. I never loved you. I married you for your money. Every nice word I ever said was a lie. And, you know, the rest of the speech. He dies. She had the good fortune of living only three more months, and she died too. Now there's a question. And I like to say that when I ask this question, if you give the wrong answer, there's a knas. There's a serious punishment if you give the wrong answer, so be careful. And the question is as follows. Did this woman have 50 years of marital bliss at the moment that she died and 3 months of misery? Or did the realization that she found out after the 50 years of marriage that the whole thing was a hoax mean that she died 3 months later, a tzibrochen, a mensch who never had a good day in her life? Remember, there's a serious consequence if you get the wrong answer. Now, I always get one in the audience who says, she had 50 great years. You know, there's, oh, yeah, you're willing to take that? Yeah. Okay. So you know what the consequence is? I offer that person a shidduch. For 50 years, you won't know that it was all phony. You just find out at the end. Or even if you'll never find out at the end, nobody ever bought it. So a story like this, basically what it says, is that here we're not talking about Yahadus, we're not talking about the Bo'yeri Olam, we're not talking about spirituality, about the Tachlis of life, but we're talking about something more than just material and physical. There's love, there's a relationship over here. If it isn't real, it doesn't mean anything. What a story like this could do is what we call evoke an urge for truth. A person begins to think, hey, you know, things in life have to be genuine. Phony is no good. We need genuine information. We have to know truth. Truth is significant. Or the other story, I think Dr. Srebrenik probably also came up with this one himself too. This story about a guy who buys his wife a beautiful diamond ring, the Queen of England probably didn't have such a diamond, and she's wearing it and showing it all over the place. And one day a friend of his comes over and he says, oh, let me see the ring. And the guy happens to be a diamond dealer, and he takes a look and he says, this is amazing, the most beautiful, perfect looking piece of cubic zirconia that I ever saw in my life. And she faints, and she's, oh, my diamond, they revive her. She faints again. And finally, he walks over to her and he says, lady, what are you getting so excited about? What are you so upset about? He says, nobody will ever know. Just don't show it to a guy like me, you know, and nobody will ever know. But it's not real. Who cares? Now, that's only a diamond. That's even less than a relationship. But the human being has this urge, this craving for truth, for reality. I don't want a diamond that's phony. I don't want a relationship that's a lie. I don't want a religion that's not true. And that third example, by the way, shouldn't be mentioned. But just when, in the general, you know, in the best conversations, this is like, not happens, funny thing happened to you on the way to the office. That would be terrible if you told them this happened to you on the way to the office. But just like, you know, I heard a little story, and one day a story about this, and you find other things similar. The idea about that there's more to life than just meets the eye, and that we need some sense of what life is all about, of true, true, true. And that, of course, is, again, has nothing to do yet with Yahadus. We're not talking about Maimon Har Sinai. We're not talking about anything. Now, if we have now some ingredients, the material world, the scientific world, they're overrated. The misconceptions about Yahadus, they're a little bit exaggerated. My questions are made to feel good. I'm respected. And this religious stuff can be questioned. And you know something? I do realize that there is a need for truth in this world, and I'd be very happy if there was some form of truth that we could achieve in this world. We have an audience who is captive, somewhat ready, somewhat interested, somewhat motivated to listen, to hear some truth. Now, if you come in at this point with the truth, may not do it. What do you mean? They're so primed. But there's one problem that's gnawing away at them. And that problem may very well be such burden, such difficulty. Oh, yes, truth. It's wonderful. Oh, I want to know the truth. Of course I want to know the truth. And I want to live the truth. And I know that truth is so important. And I know the world doesn't have anything to offer me. And I know this is a life where there's freedom to think and to ask questions. And everything is wonderful. Except for one thing, such a burden, such a burden, such a burden. Well, there is a step which I believe is critical even before they're ready to fully appreciate, comprehend, and internalize the Amitius HaTorah, the truth of Torah Misinai. And that is famous quote from the Sefer Achinuch, in the mitzvah in Parshas Vayikra, of Kol Seor v'Chol Dvash Leisaktiru Ish El Hashem, not permitted to bring Seor and Dvash on the Mizbeach. And the Chinuch, although he has written this volume as a bar mitzvah gift to his son and for his friends, and he has given Tam V'Toeles, in his words, reasons and benefits for all of the mitzvahs, and this one he stops and says, I'm not sure that I know the reason. And he's afraid almost to write anything. But then he says, I'm afraid if I do not reveal Tam V'Toeles for all of the mitzvahs, and I quote, he says, what may happen is, Pen Yivatu Bohem Mitoichkach B'Naharusom V'Yanichum Lo'ilum V'Yelchul Ahevel. They might rebel, reject, kick, rebel against all the mitzvahs in their youth, forsake them forever, and connect with the folly of this world. And therefore, he comes up with some Tam, and he asks that we shouldn't be too critical of the Tam that he chooses. I ask you, Sefer HaChinuch, he's writing to his Bar Mitzvah Bocha, this was about 500 years ago, he was one of the great Rishonim, in a world that was still sane, I assume. He gave a Tam the Toeles in every one of the other mitzvahs. Maybe Parah Aduma he didn't, that's questionable. But he's afraid if this one mitzvah, and this one, by the way, is not Nageya. It's not like his son is going to come every day to the Beis HaMikdash and say, why can't I bring my honey along? You know, like, it's not Nageya in his time. There's no Beis HaMikdash. But he's afraid that if he doesn't have Tam V'Toeles in one of the mitzvahs, he might forsake them all. The need to appreciate the benefit is so acute that if I have benefits in everything else that I do, except for one that I don't have to do anyway, just that it's part of the Taryag mitzvahs, that might be enough of an excuse to forsake everything. Sefer HaChinuch, can't do anything about it. That's what he says. But it goes even further. The Ralbag in the Te'elius at the end of Parshas Lech Lecha says that if you want to, the benefit from this parsha, he says, is if you want to convince a loved one to do something that's muzaru bitzar, something that's strange, bizarre, and painful, first tell him the benefits. And don't tell him what you want him to do. And tell him the benefits. And after he knows the benefits, the cheshit for those benefits will mitigate the pain and the strangeness, and you can tell him what you want him to do. And where do we learn this from? Avram Avinu with the Bris Milah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't tell Avram Avinu about the surgery that he was going to have to perform. He first told him, if you enter into this bris with me, you'll be legoi godoil, and you'll have children come out, generations and nations, and you'll inherit Eretz Yisrael. And only after he told him and fired him up with the cheshik for the benefits, did he dare to tell him that I want you to do something that nobody ever did before, and that's going to be very painful at your age. That's what the Rabbah says from Avram Avinu, who served Hashem on the highest level of Shleimus. Because Hashem said Shecht. But everybody needs on a certain level to appreciate the benefits, the relevance in their lives. And certainly our students need that. And I think that we'd be very mistaken if we worry more about the fact that their mitzvah should be lishmo. And that chas v'chalila, if they have any sense of benefit from the mitzvahs, they might tend to do it for the benefits rather than because it's l'shem shamayim, because it's the tzivoy Hashem, and therefore they'll be lacking something in the lishmo. I don't think they'll be lacking in the lishmo. But even if they'll be lacking in the lishmo, halevai sheyasek odom b'teiru mitzvahs afidu sheloi lishmo. Shemitoich sheloi lishmo bo lishmo. This way, they may not come to doing it sheloi lishmo, all lishmo. So it's critical to have that sense of it. Now we have the world, that's no great shakes. Misconceptions, I've become made to feel a little more comfortable with the Yiddishkeit. Questions, I see they're ready to listen to my questions. I have this gnawing urge for truth because I know that things have to be real and be genuine. And I'm not afraid of Torah anymore because I know it's for my benefit. I know it's going to make me happy. And here I have to add something which I think it's very critical. I say it all the time, so sometimes I'm getting tired even of saying it. But I think it's very critical. Ultimately, it's all about happiness. Any formula for happiness will be embraced by any human being. Formula, that's all we want, is to be happy. Problem with the world today is everybody's looking for happiness, but nobody seems to be finding it. And I think the answer is simply because we don't know what it means. If we don't know what we're looking for, then we don't know where to find it. Unfortunately, the secular world has a very strange concept of happiness. I just heard from Dr. David Pelkowitz. He spoke for us last week for the parents, and he said, if you know the shirish of the word happy, it's happenstance, haphazard, happens, hapless. It just happens. It's an accident. If you win the lottery, you're going to be happy. It's an accident. There's no cheshbon. There's no system. There's no goal. It doesn't. There's no program for happiness. Well, in our hashkofa, it's very different. A very high form of happiness is osher with an aleph. Ashrei yoshvei beisecha. David HaMelech said, Ach ha-shalti b'yeis Hashem, shivti b'yeis Hashem. That's all he wanted. Ashrei yoshvei beisecha. The sheresh in Loshon HaKodesh defines what the concept is. The sheresh seems to be ishur, the asher to validate. Happiness is about feeling good about oneself. If I feel good about myself, I'm happy. I think that that's very important because in order to get to the point of an acceptance of Torah Misinai, there has to be an individual who begins to realize that this is going to make me feel good about myself. If I do things that are going to benefit me, then I feel that I'm doing something. I'm accomplishing something. I'm doing something in the world. If I have questions that are ready to be answered, people are listening to me, I'm going to feel good about myself. If I realize that my happiness is not dependent on the material world outside, I'm going to feel good about myself. Of course, if I have something else that I can achieve it with, why? Because material happiness doesn't make a person feel good. If I need to eat or drink or imbibe or indulge in any form of outside pleasure in order to feel temporarily good, I feel bad about myself. That's what I need to feel good. I'm nothing. I'm trash. That's the way kids feel, these kids that need the outside stimulus. I'm trash. And therefore they even say they get trashed. But They're trash to begin with. If I need something from the outside, it doesn't flatter me into my own self-worth. But if I feel good about myself for who I am, for what I am, that's what does it for me. And when we get to that point, I think then people are much more ready to accept a Torah Misinai. Because what Torah Misinai contributes to the world is the undermining of the thesis that has reigned supreme in this world for the last 175 years. And that thesis is, anyone know the author of that thesis? Charles Darwin. Forgive me, please. All right. He came up with this ridiculous concept, which sold like hotcakes. Man is an accident. That's the theory of evolution reduced to its simplest component. Man is an accident. That's it. An accident. An accident means no purpose. If man is an accident and I have no purpose, how good can I feel about myself? I feel like trash. I'm nothing. Comes a Torah Misinai. Well, actually, I got my history backwards. Came a Torah Misinai. Of course, in today's world, you know, people got a little bit confused. In fact, until he came along, nobody ever doubted that. There's a creator. There was creation. At least mankind had the ability to maintain a little sanity in their own sense of self-worth. Now, our children, or our students, are more ready to accept the Torah Misinai, because this is going to give my life value. I now have purpose. I can be in touch, in truth, in touch with the purpose of my existence. Wow. I know that I want truth. I know that I want meaning. I know that the outside world is not going to do it for me. And now I can begin to find you represent that there is a way of knowing the purpose for which I was created. There is a way of connecting with the purpose for which I was put in this world. Wow, I have purpose. I have purpose. I have meaning. I have validation. I feel good about myself. This is a formula for happiness. I'm ready to listen. Problem is, can't come on too strong. Because if we come on too strong, once again, when there is pressure, there is resistance. Come on very strong, you know. One of the things I mentioned over here is that one of the worst, it's on this third sheet of Remember, to say, I'm going to prove something to you. What's your first reaction when someone says they're going to prove something to you? No, you're not. Right? All of a sudden, I wasn't resisting anything. I was in a very fine, receptive mood. You're going to prove something to me? Now I'm going to start to doubt. So we're talking about a very gentle approach. In fact, probably the best thing to do is to keep the biggest punch for later. In the process, and of course, we're talking here whether it's a few sessions or whether it's over the period of the course of a year in a classroom, a course of a semester, but it's always better to work gradually from minakal el hakovid, from the easier, from the more subtle, from the less resistant, the more resistant proof to the more difficult. And sometimes one of the nicest discussions, which really evokes a sense of wanting to agree with you, Rebbe, teacher, in what you're saying, is comparative religion. Comparative religion is a very interesting thing, because most of our kids, unless they're really turned off at this age, they'd rather be Jewish than a goy. They'd rather hear that the Jews are right than that the goyim are right. That much loyalty they have. You know, I don't know how much more, depending on who you're teaching and how they are, where they're holding and so forth. But I'd much rather something Jewish. Well, let's compare the claims of the major religions. very interesting, and it's very harmless. I'm not telling you got to be religious. I'm not telling you have to learn a koilil. I'm not telling you have to dedicate your life to anything. All I'm telling you is let's do a little exercise in Jewish pride. Let's analyze the claims of the other religions versus Yahadus. I'll never forget, it was to me a shocking experience in a session such as this with Mechanchim many years ago. And when I finished the whole discussion about what Mesira is and how a father doesn't lie to his son, and all the fathers wouldn't lie to their children, and all the Jewish fathers certainly wouldn't make up the same lie, which is ridiculous, and everybody, those, the whole generation that stood by our Sinai, and they all told their children about all these events that happened to them, and they passed it on to their children. They surely have the same story coming down in millions upon millions of chains of tradition to this very day. Doesn't make any sense, you know, that this is not reality. So a young man who was learning in Koilel, I believe, at the time, he asked me, he says, Goyim don't lie to their children either. I wasn't sure about that, by the way, sociologically, whether they do or they don't. But that wasn't really relevant. I says, yes, let's assume they don't, but what's their message? And here, when you just do a little quick sketch of the difference, it's very, very... it's something that all kids want to hear. And that is, except the ones sophisticated enough to have enough defenses to know that if I'm going to hear this message, the next step is you're going to force everything upon me and I'm going to be sitting in Koilel for 10 years. You know, but if you don't have such sophisticated students, then you might get away with this. And most of them are not that, you know. And that is, look, Christianity, Islam, the biggest, you know, what do they say? They all talk about God speaking to man. Great, beautiful, except there's one difference. They talk about a private revelation. A private revelation. Muhammad, in the middle of the night, had a dream. The historian said he was having an epileptic fit, but that's besides the point. And in Christianity, of course, it's private revelation. What's his name? In the Mormons, John Smith had a revelation in an upstate the New York hotel room. Private revelation. Whereas Judaism, the claim, forget about the truth. We're not arguing truth. We're not talking truth. We're not trying to convince. We're not trying to get anyone to be committed to anything. Just historically, what is the claim? Public miracles, which nobody else claims either, and public revelation. Millions of eyewitnesses testifying to the same historic event of what? Of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the Creator speaking to them. A Creator who had already identified himself many times over in the public miracles that were witnessed by all the millions of individuals in Mitzrayim and on the Yam Suf and so forth. Just the claim. The difference in the claim. And of course, there's a nice little story which I'm sure you're aware of, which also, you know, stories are very good because when you tell a little story, it takes the focus off the seriousness of the claim. It makes it a little clearer to them through the story. The moshel gives a little clarity, and the chuckle takes away a little bit of the resistance. So, you know, it comes across as a much easier sell. And that's the famous story about the two, about the Chassidish Rebbe that passes on. He leaves two sons. And a big battle ensues as to who's to take over as the Rebbe. This is going on for weeks and weeks, and everybody's getting involved in the battle. And finally, his youngest son walks into the shul one morning and gives a clap on the beam and says, everything's resolved. Father appeared to me in a dream, and he said, I should be the Rebbe. And of course, his brother and his faction says to him, that's very nice, but if Father wanted you to be the Rebbe, he should have appeared to us in the dream. He should have appeared to me in the dream. And that's a very simple. In other words, anybody can claim anything that he wants. But the question is, if we say that there were public witnesses, it was a public event, there were millions of witnesses, that claim has a much more credible ring to it than anything private. Private, you could either believe it or not. Public, fabricate such a story? How do you get away with it? In fact, if you want to take it a step further, if you see you have a receptive audience, you just go the next step and say like this. I have a question. How come the other copycat religions, who we know copied so much from Yahadus, we preceded them, And they did, they've copied. I mean, if you know anything about these religions, there's so many of their observances that they've copied. How come this claim they didn't copy? The winning claim, public revelation, public miracles. Nobody copied that claim. It's not like they never thought of it because they read the Bible. They built it on the Christians are still publishing the Bible in the form of an Old Testament. And the answer obviously is, and of course don't give the answer, you know, have them see the answer. And the answer is quite obvious. Can't get away with such a claim. Private revelation anybody could claim. Maybe it happened. Could be. Maybe it didn't. Public revelation? There are going to be too many people saying that the emperor is whatever he is. And therefore they're going to know that it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It didn't. How could you say such a thing? It didn't happen. It never happened. So I think that's a starting point. And again, you haven't proven anything yet. You haven't used the word, you should never use the word prove, as we mentioned. But you haven't really said anything. What you said is that, you know, this major difference between the claims, but this major difference between the claims evokes a sense of interest, of curiosity as to why, what's going on over here. Now, had we not gone through the steps of disarming them a little bit from the influence of the world and removing some of the misconceptions and evoking an urge for truth and showing them that we're willing to answer some of their questions and giving them some of the benefits of a life of Torah and Torah mitzvahs, then this question itself or the curiosity of the difference of the claims might be something that they don't even want to pay attention to. Because if I pay attention to that, I'll be in trouble. That means a life of burden. That means there's going to be trouble. That means you're going to tell me to do more. So, however, once we've gone through some of the other steps and we have an audience that's somewhat interested and motivated and realizes that there are going to be so many benefits in this life, then they're ready to listen and to hear more. I'm fond of another moshul. Let's say, you know, I always stick to seven. There are seven doors in this room. I think there may be seven exits. And I'm standing here and I'm talking, and all of a sudden, electronically, I lock one of the exits. Some people may even leave even before I start. But, you know, a couple of people might get a little bit nervous, like, what's going on? What's it locking the exits for? But nothing to worry about. There's six other exits. Continue talking for another 15 minutes and lock a second exit. All right. The nervous amongst us might be getting a little bit concerned. Another 10 minutes, lock a third exit, and a fourth, and a fifth. By the time I'm up to the sixth and the seventh, pretty much you're resigned that you're spending the night here. What could you do? Had I locked all the exits together, there would have been an uproar. The adrenaline would have roared. You guys would have broken out of the windows. Something would have happened. But once you get used to it step by step, it's not so painful. By the fifth, by the sixth, you know, start taking out your cell phone, calling home. Hey, I'm not going to make it home tonight. The same thing has to do when we come to a developing an appreciation and a realization of information that might be difficult. If it comes all at once, it's going to be too much, too overwhelming. It's too painful. And I can't listen. I bury my head. I run. I run away. I can't handle it. But when it comes gradually, piece by piece by piece by piece, and not too strong and not too forceful and not too proven and not too absolute, but gentle, subtle, kilachayad, again, like we mentioned, the funny thing happened to me on the way to the office, this story and that story, this thing and that thing. Eventually, by the time the doors are all locked, the audience is quite comfortable with the idea of spending the rest of their lives, you know, in this way of life. So I think that's a principle that has to be kept in mind as well. And one of the things that helps in this is something which, again, evokes a lot of pride, but is not so religiously overwhelming. And that is the nevuos that exist in the Torah, the nevuos that exist in Tanakh. This is something which, when you have opportunity to discuss, if it's usually, I guess, in the yeshivas, the summer parshas, we're not even there, but even parshas Bechukosai and certainly parshas Kisovoi, and we see how, and if we study, there are many books that deal with that, with the comparison between the historical record and the predictions that were made in the Torah, and they begin to see that the information, the unfolding of history, was described and predicted and prophesied and told to us in detail years, centuries before these events took place, then we begin to think, you know, that's very interesting. It sort of soars the pride in Judaism. Wow, we've got a good religion. In fact, if you tell them, and it's true, that in most religions, there are no prophecies except those that are due and payable in the next world. And of course, the reason for that is quite obvious, because in the next world you could promise whatever you want. You know, nobody ever came back to contradict you. Whereas when we talk about Torah, we talk about Yahadus, we talk about a prediction of the destruction of the Churban Bayis Rishon and the Churban Bayis Sheni, and all of the details of the Golos, and all of the anti-Semitism, and all of the exile, goylo achar goylo, one exile to the next, and constantly, and to be hated, and without a mokum, lidrisus kafregel, and all of the details, and down to the latest generation, even returning to Eretz Yisrael, all of these, it's all foretold to us up front, before they happened. Wow. There's something there. This is, I'm very proud of my Bible. I really, I feel good about it. And the truth is, if you really want to, I don't know if you go for this, but one of the dramatic contrasts sometimes work very well, is to contrast one of the very few predictions of this world that they find in Christianity. And that is that it seems there was a church elder, Chrysostom was his name, and sometime in the 2nd or 3rd century, who predicted that the Jew would never return to Israel. He was to be exiled. We were exiled already. We were spread out throughout the Roman Empire. The Jew is guilty of this terrible crime against Christianity, and therefore cursed never to return to Eretz Israel. That was the prediction. And this was a tenet of church belief. 1600 years, the prophet was doing fine. The Jews not returning in any numbers or anything, except Mamish Yechidim to Eretz Yisrael. Around the turn of the previous century, there was started with the different aliyot, and Jews were coming back in certain significant numbers. Interesting, although I have no idea if it's related, that's when the Christians began to make missions to the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. Until then, there was no such thing. But as soon as Jews started coming back, maybe there's no such thing because there are no Jews there, I don't know. But they started coming back immediately, let's convert them. I don't know what the reason was, but whatever. Comes 1948, it was a little difficult to substantiate the claim that the Jew will never return to Israel. There were 500,000 Jews there by then. There was an establishment of a state. There was what are you going to say? Well, the church modified the prophecy at the time. And the Vatican came out with an explanation saying that the prophet did not mean the Jew wouldn't return to Israel. It meant the Jew wouldn't return to the old city of Yerushalayim. No. From 48 to 67, that prophecy also did pretty well. In 67, the Jew comes back to the Yer Atika. Now what? The Vatican came out in 67, for the first time in history, labeling the old city of Jerusalem the religious capital of the three major religions of the world. It's not a Jewish city. It's the religious capital of the three major religions. That was the Nusach. from 48 to 67, when the Muslims reigned in the old city of Yerushalayim and Christianity never had a good word for Islam either, not a word was said. Nobody complained. No religious capital. Islam has old Yerushalayim, so what? The minute the Jew returns to old Yerushalayim, there's a modification now, and we say, well, this is not really a return, this is a religious capital. It seems it's very difficult to be a prophet, you know. But you look at our record, and you study the Nebuahs, and I hope tomorrow that with Rabbi Falazan, that you'll have an opportunity to go into, and if I'm going to remind him, but if he doesn't, you should ask him for some more samples of some of this information, which I think could be very good. But all this information, this is still moderate. Okay, the Torah was very smart. The Torah, prophetic. Okay, I mean, if you think about it, no human being could have known that information. But it's not, you know, you didn't sort of rub my face in the mud. There's still, it's gentle. It's gentle enough. Chazal tell us that the Gemara in Chulin says that when it talks about different simonim of the animals, the kosher animals and not kosher animals, and things that Moshe Rabbeinu knew, one of the examples there, the famous one is the chazir, that it's the only animal that's going to have split hooves and not chew its cud. And so the Gemara says, Otu Moshe Rabbeinu Kenigi hoyo iblisteri hoyo? Was Moshe Rabbeinu a zoologist or a hunter or a, you know, how did he know all this information? Like a few pages there of information. So the Gemara answers, Mikan tshuva lo'imer ein Torah min hashamayim. From here we have a tshuva to anyone who would say Torah is not min hashamayim. And the principle here is really very, very simple. And there's two, I think, concepts that are here. Number one, the Gemara does not say this is how you know Torah is min hashamayim. You don't know Torah is min hashamayim from the fact that there is tons of information there that no human being could have known. Now, I would say I should know it from that too. That's very clearly indicative, because if there's only two alternatives. It that Kodesh Baruch Hu gave it, or it was written by a man, Moshe Rabbeinu, or other people, whoever you want. So it was either human or godly. If it has information that no human at the time could have known, Moshe Rabbeinu was not all over the world. Moshe Rabbeinu certainly couldn't have known what the Mishnah says, that kol sheyeshloi kaskeses yeshloi snapir, even though yeshloi snapir veilo kaskeses, every fish that has scales has fins, even though a fish that has fins doesn't necessarily have scales. And therefore, la halacha lemaisa, all you really have to do is look for the scales, and you know that there were once fins there. Even though the Torah says you need both, the Gemara says, why la hagdil Torah v'yadir? But otherwise, that's a piece of scientific information. And it happens to be, the scientists say that there's no relationship in the development of those two systems, the scales and the fins. So it's not like they knew something that connected the two. There's no connection. It just happens to be. So this is Torah min hashamayim, of course. No. Mikan tshuvo le'uimer ein Torah min hashamayim. This is only an answer. If after everything is said and done, if the whole system of Torah min hashamayim is a person after he knows it all, and he knows Torah min hashamayim, and he still thinks maybe it's not, we got a tshuva. Fine. If that's the case, how does he know that it is? How does he know that it is? It's not from the information that no human being could have known. Well, where is it from? It's from something else. And here is also something which, I mean, we're not talking about anything that you're not aware of, but I think what we're talking about is the need to find opportunities. Now, I'm waiting for something to be brought down. I'll mention it. It'll be, I don't think we'll have copies for everybody, but it'll be made available. What we have, we're in the midst of developing it, so this is just a very, very rough draft taken from some old stuff that we used many years ago. But on each parsha, we have like a little vart or two on each parasha, which just an indicator, another indicator, Torah min hashamayim. You can't understand these facts unless you recognize that Torah is min hashamayim. And that could be something that as machanchos could be very useful, you know, to give out in a classroom as a dvar Torah to take home or to bring to the class and to mention on a Friday or to give out for them to read or to react to, or It's just like a constant ongoing process of deepening the realization and the conviction that this is the ultimate reality. However, how do we know Torah Min HaShemayim? Well, the truth of the matter is that Torah Min HaShemayim is really a very simple concept. And the concept is based upon the fact that there was a divine public revelation. Now, a public revelation, as we mentioned before, is in a whole different league from anything private. Private revelation, somebody says, Hashem appeared to me, say whatever you want, nobody knows the difference. Public revelation in front of an entire nation, that's the narrative, that's what the Torah says. By the count of the Torah, there must have been at least a few million people, men between the ages of 20 and 60, 600,000, women and children, talking about a few million nefashos, standing as an entire nation at Har Sinai, and hearing, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Onoichi Hashem Alekecho, Asher Tzisicho, Me'eretz Mitzrayim, Mi'beis Avodim. Taking this document, recorded document recorded that says that we all witnessed this event. That's what the document says. It doesn't say that we believe that there was such an event. And that's a critical difference because, you know, just to perform a little exercise to make it a little bit clearer. Take my friend in the back. You think I would lie to you? Right? You believe me? Was that I don't know? Would I lie to you? Come on. Absolutely not, right? You have no doubt about it whatsoever, right? Okay, now, I want to tell you something. I'm talking here to my dear friend who I wouldn't lie to. Okay, now, I want to tell you like this. This evening in Cedarhurst, there was an invasion from outer space. They say there were 42,000 spacemen that came off this spaceship, and somebody told me they were all dancing around, blowing a shofar, and the tzitzis were flying in the air, and somebody told me. This is what took place in Cedarhurst this evening, okay? Now, remember, I'm the guy who would never lie to you. Like, your father would never lie to you. What do you know? Well, all he knows is that I believe, you said I think, but it's the same thing, right? He knows that I believe that this happened. So now what do you people know? You know that I believe that this event took place. You don't know it took place. I wouldn't lie. I'm not lying. I truly believe it took place. I heard it from a liar, but that's beside the point. However, what if I told you I witnessed this event myself as I was coming over here this evening? Now, cut the jokes and don't say what you think of me. What do you know now?
You're a liar.
Now you know I'm a liar. Okay. No. And the answer is that now he knows that this event took place. Because if I say I saw it and I would not lie, then that is an establishment that that's testimony. That's eyewitness testimony. What? That's right. I saw it. I know it. Now, imagine millions of people witnessing events and recording in the document, and by the way, the document is full, and it's very good if you come to these psukim to point them out. Atem re'isem asher sisi b'mitzrayim. Atem re'isem shemin ha-shamayim dibarti imochem. The Seres HaDibros is sandwiched in between the re'isem b'mitzrayim and atem re'isem shemin ha-shamayim dibarti imochem. Mamish, like, again and again, it's mentioned so many times that this document is not the product of the belief of the people who are passing it on to their children. But it is an eyewitness testimony of what we witnessed. And all of these millions of people passing this on to their children, the same document, the same story, it's powerful. It's powerful. It's clear that these events actually took place. Now, I hope that I'm going to ask also Rabbi Kalazan. There's a beautiful moshul that really brings this to life, which clarifies any possibility of any question, which I'm going to ask him to discuss tomorrow as well, because I think that will be helpful and give you a lot of information that you could use. But here we're more concerned with just giving the overview of the principles. So, Torah Min HaShemayim is a reality. Now, there's a second point of Torah Min HaShemayim, and I think that this is something that everybody, I personally recommend, everybody should get one of these. Rabbi Leib Kelman from Yerushalayim. Personally, well, he claims, that, but he says he researched it, not that he heard about it. This is a directly from Sinai to you. And this is something, you know, I, in an audience like this, I don't assume there's a doctor in the audience. Is there usually, when I have a Jewish audience, there's always one doctor. And I ask the doctor, I say, "Doctor, could you tell me who your mentor was?" And he usually knows the name. I say, "Who was your mentor's mentor?" And he says, half the time they know. "And who was your mentor's mentor's mentor?" And rarely do I ever get an answer. And then I didn't used to have this, but now I can read it. I says, I knew it by heart anyway, but I studied by Rabbi Henoch Leibowitz, studied by Rabbi David Leibowitz, studied by the Altam Slabot, studied by Rabbi Simcha Zichel of Kelm, studied by Rabbi Yisrael Salanto, who studied by Rabbi Zilnemi, studied by Rabbi Chaim Velazhe, studied by the Vilna Goyin, Rabbi Eliyahu Kramer has his name, who studied by Rabbi Shlomo Zalman, studied by Rabbi Yisrael Chaber, studied by Rabbi Eliyahu Chossi, who studied by Rabbi Yisrael Kramer, who studied by Avram Gumbiner, who studied by the Be'er HaGoyle, who studied by... It goes from me. So my name is here too. One of my friends put it in there. All the way back, Moshe, in 1272 BCE. Powerful. If you could, if you're graphically inclined, and you want to make one of these, maybe wait till you have Talmidim or Talmida. I don't know, Talmida is mostly men on this thing, I think. But anyway, but you want to put your name and then their name, you know, and trace them all the way back. It's a beautiful exercise. But it's powerful. There's no such thing like this in the world. Imagine knowing from Sinai all the way to today. And by the way, this is only one chain. I'm sure there must be hundreds, thousands of others. He just traced one of who learned by him and who saw him and who heard from him and who heard from him. And it's an amazing thing. There's nothing like it in the world. So we're talking about public revelation, public miracles, public knowledge. We're talking about an entire generation passing this on to their children. And we're talking about, and he'll speak tomorrow more in detail, about this system being passed on generation to generation. We know the names and we know the social security numbers of each and every generation of Mekablei HaTorah Ad Hayom Hazeh. It's very, very powerful. And if you, especially, I really, I strongly recommend, we've got to figure out how to get this to every machanach. That every machanach walks into the room about the, once after you teach them something, so they should be called your talmidim after that's a month or two or three or four or five or six until everybody learns something, and then come in with each kid's name. Have your name, your Rebbe's name, it all goes back to Slavotkum and stuff. That's where everybody stems from. And then you have your kid's name. It's an amazing thing. And it connects them. And it's these things that make a difference. What's that? You print it up. I don't know anything about the graphics. But anyway, so we're talking about now a Torah Misinai. We're talking about, and this, I call this testimony. In fact, I'll never forget after the presentation that hopefully you'll hear tomorrow, and forgive me for back and forth like this, but I was once giving a seminar in Los Angeles many years ago. And I had come a little bit late, so I didn't know who the Olam was exactly. And I was explaining this idea of testimony that existed from Sinai, public revelation, and everybody hearing the same thing, speaking, Hashem speaking, and passing it down and telling their children in the document that they witnessed these events and passing it down generation to generation accurately in the same Sefer Torah throughout the world. In Teman for the last 2,000 years before the establishment of Israel, they were all separated from the rest of Klal Yisrael. The same Sefer Torah, the same everything that's identical throughout the Torahs. It's mind-boggling. So I was presenting this argument, and there was a woman, I remember she was standing with her hands against the wall like this, everyone was sitting, she was standing there, she looked like she was ready for a fight, and she says, she asked a question, and I thought from her question that she didn't understand what I was talking about. So I said, wait a minute, suppose you were a judge in a courtroom, and all of a sudden everybody broke out laughing, because it was unbeknown to me, I came late. But this one was a judge in the California Supreme Court or something like this, you know. Anyway, and so I says, with the evidence that I presented, what would you decide if you had to decide? Was the Torah given on Sinai? And she said to me, I'll never forget, with far less evidence than you presented in my courtroom, it would have been decided that this, in fact, Torah was given from Sinai. So that's the testimony. We have testimony. We don't need anything more. But I would like to mention just one point, which I think is also very important. Before, actually, I think it's a point that I neglected. That's why I want to put it in here now. All of this doesn't mean anything, and this is a very important point, unless we have some system of a standard for truth. For example, if our students don't know, I just had this with a young man this morning. He was... it came out after a half-hour discussion that he was disputing the truth of Torah Misinai, although he claimed that he recognized its truth, but he was very confused. If there isn't a standard for establishment of truth, then all of the discussions that we're having here have no context. What do I mean? How do you determine truth? How do you know if something is real? How do you know if it really happened? What's the level of information, of indication, of knowledge that you have to have in order to know that something is true? Well, if the level is, let's take two possible approaches to it. The level is, it has to be beyond the shadow of a doubt. That sounds good. Beyond the shadow of a doubt. Well, does anybody know anything, or is there anyone who conducts their life with a level of knowledge beyond the shadow of a doubt? Anyone? Anybody who takes medicine beyond the shadow of a doubt that it's going to damage you? Anyone who drinks the drinking water beyond the shadow of a doubt that it's not going to poison you? Anyone who gets into a car to drive across the street who can say beyond the shadow of a doubt that they're going to get there? Anybody who knows that their mother is their mother beyond the shadow of a doubt? I'll never forget my daughter. She's married now, so I'm not worried about telling the story for shidduchim or anything, but she was about 7 or 8 years old, and I came down one morning downstairs to my study, and she's looking through my safe, my papers. I don't know, what are you looking for? She's looking for her adoption papers. All of a sudden, it occurred to her, maybe she's adopted. You know, she wasn't. But anyway, it's how do you know? It's beyond any reasonable doubt. That's what my judge in the California State Court or whatever it was uses, and that's the standard that we use everything. The only knowledge that we have for everything that we do, life and death, you take a life and death operation, it's only beyond any reasonable doubt. There's no such thing. In fact, if you try to establish something beyond the shadow of a doubt, you're going to induce the seeing of shadows. Because once, that's the standard shadow. But maybe, who knows? So it's beyond any reasonable doubt. This has to be established before this process can begin. And again, the best way, if you're going to give all of this in one night and try to get it all in without a break so that we should finish at a reasonable time, it's not going to work that way. We're dealing with teachers, so that's superhuman power. But in a classroom, and over a long period of time, at one day you just talk just about the standard for knowledge, not related to Maimon Har Sinai, not related to Yahadus, not related to anything. Just a conversation, you know, about how does anyone know anything is true? How do you know? Now we know there's a standard. Once there's a standard, now we can evaluate and see. Is the information that we have strong enough to withstand the test of beyond any reasonable doubt to be considered testimony? And the truth of the matter is that judge and the judges of all the generations of Jewish history have decided that the knowledge that we have beyond any reasonable doubt, that there was, in fact, the Maimon Har Sinai in front of millions of eyewitnesses who recorded this in the document. And the document said that not that they believed that it happened, but that they witnessed that it happened. And they took this document and passed it on to their children and their grandchildren, each one through millions and millions of different chains of transmission, that to this very day we're passing on this same document to our children 3,320 years later. It's certainly beyond any reasonable doubt, and again, you'll hear more about that hopefully tomorrow, that this is a reality. Nope. What about the Omer Ein Torah Min HaShemayim? Who's this guy? Who's the Gemara talking about? The Gemara is not saying this is how we know Torah Min HaShemayim because Moshe Rabbeinu knew information that no human being could have known. The Gemara says, Tshuva le'Omer Ein Torah Min HaShemayim. I dare say the Gemara doesn't say it, but maybe Tshuva to the Meshugina, the guy who's going to say Ein Torah Min HaShemayim, but it's not fair. I wouldn't call him a Meshugina. I would call him a human being. A human being who maybe made a cheshbon and says, yeah, Torah Min HaShemayim, but, oy, si shverz zayin ayid. How am I going to do it all? What's going to be so much burden? Today you could say it's so expensive. Tuition costs so much. The public schools are free. An esrog costs a fortune. Who knows what's going to cost this year, noch in a shmita year. I mean, like, I'm not allowed to pay for it, though. But anyway, so to such a person, tshuva le'omer ein Torah Min HaShemayim means if after all of this, if all the pressures, if all the burdens, if all the responsibilities, if all the difficulties, with all of those emotional interferences, that you're going to worry and think that, oh, it's too much, it's too much, it's too much, it's too much, and you start with these nerve-wracking doubts that, well, maybe, and who knows, and maybe this, and maybe that. And people have come up with scenarios. I've heard some of the most creative, insane scenarios that people come up with to explain how there could have been such a public recording of public information that everybody knew and that everyone passed on, and to say that maybe still there's some element there of there's some weakness in that chain, which is so irrational to believe. So there, Chazal say, but the Torah is full of evidence as well as testimony. Evidence and testimony. So really, there are three parts to the Torah Min HaShemayim as we talked about strengthening Emunah in the classroom. There's, of course, the realization that it's toiv v'yofe v'nechmod v'noim v'mesukon u'mekubol. It's good. It's beneficial. It's going to make me happy. It's going to give meaning and purpose and happiness, bring happiness to my life. That's critical. Otherwise, the mind is closed, the focus is down, the ADD kicks in. I'm not interested in hearing anything about it. Even when that is understood, and there's an urge, so to speak, and we've told him the story about the diamonds and about the Hollywood actor, and there's an urge for some truth and meaning in life. But even at that point, we have to open our minds and we have to hear there is testimony. Testimony is powerful. Testimony is powerful. But testimony still, well, testimony maybe somebody made a mistake, maybe, you know, there's still a door left open that somebody might be able to question. But then the third piece, evidence. Evidence is the pshat. If you question anything about the veracity of the testimony, then I share with you this evidence, which is truly incontrovertible. And that refers to so much information that Chazal, both in Torah Shebichsav, Torah Shebal Peh, that was known at a time thousands of years before they could any possibly have known it. Now here, of course, Nevuah can be reintroduced with a greater strength to it, because initially it was presented as a soft sell just to give a certain sense of pride and to give us the realization that, hey, there's something that sounds good. The Goyim can't do this. They messed up when it came to the Jews returning to Eretz Yisrael. You know, they couldn't do that one for too long. It didn't last forever. And yet our Nevuah, everything is predicted throughout from the beginning right to this very day. We have Nevuah right through. The Holocaust is clearly indicated in Parshas Hazinu. And that's part of it. But now, if a person really still would feel the need to resist, we talk about hardcore evidence. One of the most famous, and there's a piece here, if I'm not mistaken, this piece was in the advertisement for this session, a piece from Reb Moshe in the Igros Moshe, I think so, where Reb Moshe has a little vort, which is very, very telling. We know that it says, Vayedabra Hashem al Moshe Bahar Sinai. And the Torah teaches us Parsha Shemitah. So Rashi brings from Chazal the famous question, Mayin Shemitah Etzel Har Sinai. Why did the Torah have to tell us, Dafka, when it's telling us about the Parsha of Shemitah, it has to say that it was Bahar Sinai? Why didn't it tell us by another Parsha? So Rashi says, because it comes to teach us that just like this Parsha was given at Sinai and called Diktukeo Proteo, so too the entire Torah was given at Har Sinai. And Reb Moshe and I saw once from the Chassam Sofer, he asked the same Kasha. He asks, he says, so why couldn't he tell it to us by another mitzvah? Could have said any mitzvah. Mitzvah tzitzis. Vayadabra Hashem, vayimra Hashem, v'moshe b'har Sinai. You learn that tzitzis was given at Har Sinai, and from there you learn that all the other mitzvahs were given by Har Sinai. So the answer that the mitzvah Shemitah is clearly indicated that it was given by Har Sinai, you can't dispute it. Why? Because when Moshe Rabbeinu comes and tells the Klal Yisrael about mitzvah Shemitah, and they say, well, what are we going to eat? You know, if there's not going to be, we're not going to be able to plant, we're not going to be able to harvest, and we're going to go without eating in the seventh year, and then the eighth year, we won't have planted, and the seventh year will be hefker. Well, how are we going to survive? So Moshe Rabbeinu, of course, could have said, well, we'll store in the other years, as, you know, there was precedent for that, then we'll have what to eat this year. Or he could have suggested that they keep Shemitah in the north in the third year, and in the south in the seventh year. They could have made some cheshbon. No. What does he say? The tzivisi es birchosi bashono hashishis, ve'osos es oretz l'shloish hashonim. Hashem will help. There'll be a miracle. The sixth year will have a bumper crop that shall have enough for the sixth, for the seventh, and for the eighth. Who could make such a comment? According to natural law, had this not been Torah Sinai, then after the seventh, well, I guess to the sixth year, there's no bumper crop, and the seventh year is nothing to eat, and the eighth year is nothing to eat, it's all over. Moshe Rabbeinu is a charlatan. The Teretz is that this mitzvah of Shemitah is clearly indicative that it had to be from HaKadosh Baruch Hu from Har Sinai, because no human being could have guaranteed such a thing. And there are other mitzvahs like that. And there's so much. I mean, there's scientific information. And I mean, today there's books about it you can buy. It's so much. I mean, modern day psychology and sociology and science. And any time we find a piece of information where Chazal were clearly aware and clearly told us, you know, the famous thing, there was an article in the New York Times, I think it was in July in 1990, that's 18 years ago, where it said it was entitled Scientific Talmudic Wisdom, Ancient Talmudic Wisdom Confirmed by Modern Science. And they came up with this idea that that although until that time everybody believed that the determination of whether an embryo would be male or female takes place at the moments of conception, science discovered that really the final determination only takes place between the 42nd and the 47th day, I think it said, something like that. And of course they found that this is what Chazal tells us, the Gemara says on the Mishnah, that until 40 days you could be mispalosh etele lishti zocher, because it's not confirmed until then. And then when they asked, the New York Times continues, when they asked this rabbi, who was a Talmud teacher, what does he say about the discrepancy? And his answer was, well, science is finally catching up. You know, 20, 42, 46, they're getting there. Soon they'll be at day 40. So when the information that we can find, and again, if we give a lecture that says, today I'm going to tell you 100 pieces of scientific information that science discovered in the last 25 years that Chazal knew for the last 2,500 years. Worst thing to do. It's so powerful. So powerful. What could be better? Too powerful is no good. Because we're fighting a Yetzer Hara. We're fighting pressure. We're fighting this fear of being overwhelmed. This fear of being forced into a shibud that may be too much for us to handle. But if you were to come into the classroom every day, and, you know, like, I guess you can't use that line every day. A funny thing happened to me on the way to work today. But every day you come in and think, you know, look what I saw yesterday. I saw this, I read this, and you know, I saw, look at that. Wow, interesting. Science finally discovered this, and science finally discovered. And after a while, kids get a message. And this is basically the approach that we have to use, that after a while there's a message that sends home clearly that, hey, this Torah, even if I would want to say Ein Torah min haShamayim, despite the fact that there's so much testimony, but there's also so much pressure, and if I would wish to resist, I can't, because there's such clear-cut evidence that no human being could have presented this other than the Creator Himself. The hour is late, and I would like to encourage a couple of questions and discussion here before we conclude. There's another point, I think, that's also, but very, very important. All of this is really only maximally effective in the context of a warm, close, and bonded relationship. If there isn't a positive relationship in the classroom, then with the students, then there's no willingness to be makabel. The willingness to be makabel, what the Rebbe, what the Moro says, is based upon the fact that we have a connection. That there's love, there's warmth, there's feeling, there's caring, there's a kesher. In the context of that kesher, then there's the willingness, there's the desire, there's the craving to be makabel from that teacher. Without that kesher, we don't have that willingness, and therefore we can lose so much of such powerful information and so many opportunities. Is lost in this process. All right, there's really a lot of other things I'd like to discuss. There's a couple of other outlines that you have. Just to run through in 2 minutes, just a couple of things to remember. In all of this discussion, never put somebody down. The minute you put a person down, you've lost that receptive audience. You know, it should always try to understand what the person is saying and then show an alternative point of view. As we mentioned before, if you speak too strongly or absolutely or say that you're going to prove it, that's not the way. It has to be soft and gentle. Never get into an adversarial situation. If you wish to be the one who will convey emuna, the yesoides of emuna, yedias Hashem, yedias haTorah miSinai, to talmidim, to talmidos, then there can't be any personal friction. It can't get personal. If it gets personal, this individual I was speaking with this morning said something which was so ridiculous. I almost lost myself, and I'm doing this for so many years, and I don't think he noticed it, but I'm not even sure. But it was like, so stupid. How could you say such a thing like that? But never. It's always with the greatest respect, with the greatest love, with the greatest patience. Never. And it isn't personal. It's not a personal attack on you. They're attacking Deire Deiris, you know. So a person has to look at that. We have to treat everybody with respect. If I respect my students, they will respect me and my opinion, and that makes a big difference. I mentioned earlier about the little bit of humor. An overly serious presentation is sort of evokes resistance or defense mechanisms, like, oh, they're trying to do a number on me, they're trying to brainwash me. Whereas, you know, if it's more casual, if it's easygoing, if it's friendly, if it's more even humorous, it makes a difference. Now, this last point here is a little bit harder for chinuch, and it's much more in the world of Balei Tshuva. But we can't get into the difficulties before we get the basic principles across. In other words, if they're going to be focused on how difficult it is if you just finished a very difficult lesson on a topic that they don't want to hear in halacha, that's the difficult halacha for them to deserve. And next to that, we're going to have the class to show you Torah Misinai. You could almost be assured of failure. In fact, when you begin this process, you almost hope that they forgot that they're a Tariyat Mitzvahs. You almost hope that they're not mired or burdened by this sense of how many obligations and how many responsibilities, because it's much easier to penetrate when I don't feel that the stakes are so high, that the cost is going to be so great. Okay, that's just some general ideas. I just want to mention, I was asked to mention that if you've left an email address here, you could get access to, I'm not sure how it's going to work exactly, but I guess they'll inform you about, we hope to have a weekly, like, Emuna Chizuk, you know, one of these things coming out, and everybody who is interested in that could get that, something that you could use in the classroom, something that you can incorporate into your teaching, something that should be helpful in this area. So tomorrow evening you'll have the second session, which will flesh out a lot of these, give you a lot of examples of material that could be used in this context, and hopefully that should be very beneficial. It's late, it's hot. Yes?
The ideal way of implementing this concept in a classroom is through using it in the regular curriculum that you're doing, or a separate subdivided thing?
No. The more you can intersperse it into something else, the less it evokes resistance. The less the antenna are up, the less they pay attention. In other words, you don't want it. If you present it as a unit, then you might evoke resistance in some people. You know, in fact, you might evoke some resistance in everybody on different levels, but certainly in some people there will be resistance. Whereas if it's interdispersed, it's almost like it's not noticed. It's, you know, I don't know, it gives away both my age and maybe it says something less than flattering, but I remember as a kid there was such a thing in the movies where, I'm not saying I was there, but where they would see all of a sudden a Coke bottle would flash on for like 2 seconds and everybody would run out to buy a Coke. You know, something that goes in that way that they almost don't even notice that they're getting, that's a much...
Subliminal.
Subliminal. That's a much more effective way of communicating. Yes?
Step two, or if you gotta remember, was that the student has to feel that it's good for them and it gives them purpose mm-hmm. meaning. So you come to a point in the classroom where like, the student will turn and say, so what's my purpose? So what purpose do I need to have?
Well, that's a very good question. Got another hour. Basically, you know, the Mesillas Yeshorim in the first perek describes probably in the most succinct form the purpose of creation, in that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, being the totally perfect being that he is, needing absolutely nothing in his world, only wanted to do chesed. And in order to do chesed, he created a world, he created people, he created chesroinus to be able to fill. And this basically is what the whole world about, is just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to do chesed. The way to do chesed is, of course, to give us the opportunities to earn the chesed, because if we don't earn the chesed, we don't deserve the chesed, it's not really chesed, because we can't appreciate the chesed. We only appreciate that which we have earned or we have deserved. You know, so therefore, we have a life where we're given certain raw materials. Each person is given his own and her own personality and midos and opportunities and nisyonos and challenges. And we're to work with them to perfect ourselves in the best possible way. Lo nitna chazal say Torah mitzvahs elo litzareif b'henes habriyos. Torah and mitzvahs are only given to purify mankind. And we work to develop ourselves, and in that way we find closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is the ultimate uplifting and source of validity and happiness in this world. And through that we soar and we're able to receive Hashem's chesed beyond. Do not emphasize, in my personal opinion, the benefits that are beyond this life. No kid growing up today has any patience for benefits that are more than 3 days away. All right? 3 days is too much. 3 hours? 3 minutes. All right? So it's not that after 120, you're going to have the Gresteglicken. That's not what I want to hear. They have to understand the benefits in this world, the happiness, the fulfillment, the closeness to Hashem, the sense of meaning, the sense of connection, the sense of giving makes a person feel good. He feels good about himself. The sense of fulfilling my purpose that Hashem wanted me to bring perfection to myself and to this world in order to be able to give me the greatest of schar later on, here and there, is like, I'm doing my purpose. I'm doing for what I was created. I have a purpose. I have a close connection with Hashem. The truth of the matter is that maybe on a simpler level, kids can appreciate what it means to have a relationship with Hashem. Because life today is so difficult that most people are sophisticated enough to realize if I had a closer relationship with God, I'd probably be able to handle the world in a much better way. I could find solace and strength and peace of mind even in the midst of great difficulty. So, you know, that's, but that, you know, there's much written about that, but that's the general sense. Yes?
I just want you to know, with kids who are, if you were talking about 12, 13 teenagers, no, what you just said is something that if I got up in front of a seminary class, and that would be a beautiful hashkafa lesson, and the students would, you know, I say seminary because the side of the pizza, and they would be ready to like take it in and feel the beauty and the purpose of it. You know, we just had to hate it, and it's, we don't want nama de kisufa, and we want. But when you're talking to a teenager today who hasn't, you know, come to, you know, I'm thinking girls ready to go to seminary who really want to, like, this is like my last chance, and I want to hear and I want to know what life's all about because it's serious stuff next year. But if you're talking to teenagers, Hashem wants to do good. But my mother, I don't get along with, my whatever, where's the good?
Well,
I don't see it. I go to school, maybe my father lost his job, you know, maybe, you know, there are things going on around me. So,
correct. I mean, that again.
I'm not yet ready to hear what the Chavos HaOlam says, you know. Chavos HaAdam.
Yeah. Well, that's again another hour, and it's hot and late. But I would just say to that, there's definitely we need some sense of being able to deal with the suffering in this world. I mean, that's really, this is tzadik v'raloi. This has been an issue since Moshe Rabbeinu and Yirmiyahu HaNovi, and in every generation since then. A whole Sefer Iyov is written to deal with this issue. But I think that.
If we're not talking about, let's say, you don't want to talk to the kids about, like, what's lachem eves for me.
No. In this world, I think there's one. I think there's one simple concept, and it's not simple really, and it's much more complex in this whole issue of suffering. But there's one simple thing, and that is as follows: to the degree that I have a close relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's to that degree that whatever difficulties I'm going to go through in life, those difficulties are going to be more bearable. It's going to help me through. Besides the fact, and that's a whole different discussion that takes a lot of work, that it's going to help me out of the difficulties, but it's certainly going to help me through the difficulties. When I suffer, whatever I may be suffering, and I know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is with me, and I know that there is a purpose, and I know that he is in control, and I know that he is meitiv, and I know that he has a cheshbon for everything. That realization, which can only come, by the way, of a life that is has experienced his hashgacha protis and his warmth and his caring. We didn't talk about hashgacha protis at all, which is another whole discussion, how critical that is to show them, to get them to recognize, to feel. If I felt in my life hashgachas Hashem, hashgacha protis, then even when he's dealing with me in a way that I really don't understand and I don't like, it becomes easier to bear because I know he's with me. You know, I heard once from my father-in-law, Zecherno Livrocha, the pshat shivtecho mishantecho heimo yenachamuni. So a shevet is a whip. A mishenes is a thing you lean on. So the mishenes, I understand, is an achoma. How is the shevet an achoma? So he gave a marshal. I think I saw it someplace else also, once that imagine a shepherd and has a flock of sheep and they're grazing on a beautiful day all over the place, and finally it's becoming nightfall and he's trying to gather in every one of them. And there's one little shepsela that's got lost someplace, and it's starting to get dark and he's looking for the shepherd, and the shepherd's out looking for him, and all of a sudden the shepherd spots him there in the distance and cracks the whip over his back. And the shepsela feels such nechoma. My shepherd is still with me. He has. If a person can recognize, can develop a positive enough relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that in the time of difficulty, I know that he's there for me. I know that he's helping me. I know that he has a cheshbon, even if I don't understand it, and even if I allow myself to disagree with it, but I know that he's there. It gives a whole new quality of life. I remember in the olden days in Los Angeles when I had an oilam there that was very far from where they should be. I used to tell them, until my wife corrected me and told me that from a point of view of chinuch, it's not correct to say. I used to say, if you're to live this life with the strength that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you, and if you come up in the oilam ha'emes and you find out that the whole thing was a mistake, it was still kedai. Don't ever say that. I shouldn't even repeat it. You know, my wife chastised me about it. But the point was that forget all the benefits there, here in this world. This feeling of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives you the strength to continue on despite what's going on. It's mamish. Ask anyone who's going through suffering, it's the only source of strength. And the truth of the matter is, the difference is, the people who have somewhat of a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when they have difficulty, it enhances the relationship. The people who don't have that relationship, when they have difficulty, they break. They crack. So these are things even that young teenagers are going through a lot of turmoil. And I have to tell you a little story. I was once invited, maybe about 20 years ago, to give a session for teachers that were leaving Yerushalayim to go to Budapest to start the first day school there in 40 years. And the session before, they were talking about teaching about the Yom Nevoim. They were going for Elul without mentioning the name of Hashem, because Hashem hadn't been there for 40 years, so you can't mention it. And I was fuming at the stupidity of the discussion. And when it came my turn, I got up and I says, you know, I disagree. I think you have to mention Hashem. And I'll tell you something else. I think you have to talk from the very beginning about having a relationship with him. And one of the people there was an advisor from some organization. He asked me, what do you do if they laugh at you? And I said, you know, I've been talking to secular groups for decades about relationship with Hashem, and nobody ever laughed. To the contrary, everybody's jealous. Everybody wants a relationship with the Creator, with the boss, with the controller, with the Almighty, with the Master. I heard, unbeknown to the president of this group that I had discussed this, after the first week in school, the guy tells me, he says, you know, the first day of school, there was a very interesting incident. A little Hungarian girl came home, a six-year-old kid, and she came home and told her parents, Mommy, Daddy, guess what? There's God in the world. And the family literally rejoiced. Everybody craves that. And teenagers, if anything today, our teenagers are like frustrated and bereaved adults of the 20, 30, 40-year-old group. They're going through such turmoil. There's so much difficulty. If it isn't personally, it's their friends. It's all around. And they're ready and they're capable. But they have to hear it from us with a conviction. They have to feel it. They have to sense it, b'chush, that this is real to us. They have to see, and this is b'chlal and achinuch from the very earliest stages. We have to nurture them on Hashem's Ashgocha Protis in this world, showing them incidents, story after story after story, Ashgocha Protis, and showing what happens in this world and how Hashem takes care of this world. And you take that, and then when they have difficulties, or even before the difficulties, they begin to sense the importance, the need for a positive relationship, for trust in Hashem, the power of tefillah, and they connect with Hashem, and this connection can do them wonders. And they're ready for it. They're craving for it. I dare say a little bit we're disappointing them that we're not giving them enough of it. Shkoyach, kol tov.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.